It's Wednesday, March the 9th, 2011. The radio program marches on. Bob McCown, Stephen Brett in our Toronto studios. It's the nation's most listened to sports talk presentation. It's primetime sports on the Fan Radio Network, coast to coast, on Sirius, Channel 97. And if you don't own the radio, you can watch us on TV, on all the Rogers Sports Network. There's not a damn one that is carrying anything else but us. Don't know why? That's just the way it is. Pick a channel, any one of the five, and we're on everywhere. Glenn Healy a little bit later on. Michael Boone of the Montreal Gazette will join us in a bit as well. Off the top, yesterday, Gary Bettman, I think Bill Daly, too. Wasn't Daly there, too?
I think he was there. He didn't speak. He didn't appear at the presser, from what I could see.
They don't let Daly talk when Gary's there. That's been my experience.
They should let Daly talk more often.
I would think that would be
he's
good.
He's a good face for the league.
Anyway, so Gary Bettman, commissioner of the National Hockey League, went to Glendale. I was going to say Phoenix, but I think technically Glendale. I don't know why he was there. Maybe to try and cut a deal. Maybe to just make an announcement. And I don't know what he announced. Do you understand what he announced?
Well, I think he went and talked to the stakeholders in Glendale. He talked to the politicians and to the people who work for the team and said, we're doing everything we can. And then he was unsuccessful in having a behind-closed-doors meeting with the Goldwater Institute. So then he had a press conference where he blamed them for everything.
Yeah, well, I think that pretty much summarizes it. And the issue at hand that's been at hand for the last at least week, maybe 2 weeks, has been the desire on the part of those involved and those that would like to see the Coyotes stay in Phoenix to get some kind of an indication from the Goldwater Institute whether they plan to take any action if, in fact, these bonds are actually sold. Darcy Olson is the president and CEO of the Goldwater Institute and joins us on the telephone. Ms. Olson, very good of you to take time for us today. How are you?
Oh, my pleasure to be with you.
You understand that those that are interested in this story, those that are involved in this story, seem focused on one question, and that is, what will the Goldwater Institute do if these bonds are allocated in some way, shape, or form? Will you file an action?
And
Have you decided?
We'll do what it takes. I mean, that's the bottom line here. We have a record of going to court on corporate bailouts like this one. And if that becomes necessary, we will. But, you know, we're not litigious. We're hoping that the city of Glendale will do the right thing, that it will come up with a deal that complies with the Arizona Constitution, that it will find a buyer who's willing to buy the team with his own money. And then that's a win-win. It's a win for the taxpayers, and it's a win for the local fans of the Coyotes.
If there is then any sort of bond issue, and I stress any sort, because we've heard there was a story out yesterday, the day before, about the possibility of lowering the total bonds from, I think, $116 million down to $70. If there is any bond issue, am I to assume that the Goldwater Institute would have opposition?
If taxpayer money is going to a private businessman, absolutely. I mean, we have this Arizona Coyotes situation is really similar to America's GM situation when Congress bailed out GM using taxpayer money.
Right.
But under the Arizona Constitution, those kinds of government bailouts are just not permissible. You can't use taxpayer money to prop up a failing business at taxpayer expense. And unfortunately for the Coyotes, they have lost money every year since they've been here. Since 1996.
Right.
And there's just no reason to believe that tomorrow somehow they're going to turn into a moneymaker here.
Darcy, I want to ask you about two things that Commissioner Bettman, I guess, alluded to last night in his Q&A session with reporters. One was that he seemed confused about the motivation of the Goldwater Institute. He was asked about, you know, why do you think they're doing this, and he kind of shook his head and said, I just don't know. And the other thing was that he certainly suggested that it was unusual that the Goldwater Institute sent letters to some of the investment banks, you know, who might have been directing people towards this bond issue, saying, we may have problems with this. This may violate the gift clause, just so you know. That kind of, you'd gotten out ahead of that and sent those letters. Number one, was there anything unusual? Was that a different tactic, and why did you do it? And, you know, is there anything about your motivation here that we don't know?
Well, our motives are clear. We are who we say we are. We're a taxpayer watchdog organization. And as I said before, we had a really big case that went up to the Arizona Supreme Court just last year on this issue, in which we prevailed on behalf of taxpayers. Our interest is in protecting the Constitution. And that's it. That's the beginning and the end of our motivation. So there you go. You know, it's funny. People have said, well, why did you send those letters to the bond folks? And and what we said was, well, what if we hadn't done that, hadn't let anybody know, and then we just sued the city? You know, what we're trying to do here is to prevent having to do something that drastic. And so our tactic was not unusual. It was to simply educate all policymakers and interested parties about the Arizona Constitution and about the concerns we had with this deal. So we felt like that was our duty, to be as transparent as possible and let people know what was going on with this deal.
Did you understand that as a result of sending those letters, though, that you would also potentially chill the market for these bonds, you know, freeze it solid, it would appear?
Well, I mean, you know, Moody's, just right around this whole time period, had downgraded Glendale's bonds because this particular city has debt that is three times the national average for cities of its size. So you have a city here that is sorely fiscally mismanaged. And, you know, I don't know what impact this potential unconstitutional, what appears to us to be unconstitutional bonding might have on that. But, you know, they have had some real problems, and I think that really they need to look to their own house and get it in order.
With Darcy Olson, the president, CEO of the Goldwater Institute. I have made the, I tried to make the point over the last several weeks, Ms. Olson, that the issue here is less about the Goldwater Institute's, and for lack of a better word, I'm going to use threat, but rather the fact that no one has stepped up to purchase the bonds, either in a public forum or privately, whether there's been a 5 or 6% interest rate offered or an 8 or 9% interest rate offered. And that I've tried to explain to people that, you know, while, you know, the threat of litigation could be, have a chilling effect, the truth is that somebody who is prepared to purchase the bonds wouldn't really face any serious liability or risk. It'd be almost like buying a house. The deal would go into escrow. There may be some small down payment. And then whatever action was going to be taken would be taken. As you understand the process, is that accurate? That in effect, you would not sue the bond purchaser. Your action would be against the city of Glendale, perhaps Mr. Hulsizer, perhaps the National Hockey League, but that the purchaser would not be named in this and in the action?
You know, I think that is correct. I'm not sure, and you never know who would be named in a situation like that. I think that the reason, you know, that investors, I mean, at least locally in the newspaper, have been saying that they're not interested in these bonds is that these are always a high risk type of bond.
Right.
And, you know, it doesn't matter what the Goldwater Institute says about this issue. These investors are pretty savvy. They know what the law of the land is here. And they know that the city of Glendale has been hiding the ball. They know that they haven't disclosed public documents. That raises questions. Why won't they disclose those documents? Why did it take a court order to get any of those documents to show up in the public hands in the first place? I think, you know, whether we're here or not to challenge this, investors know that something fishy is going on.
Is it accurate that either Gary Bettman requested a meeting with you or you offered a meeting, but that your criteria in either case was to do it in a public forum, not privately? Is that accurate?
Yes, that is correct. And the Monday, I think it was Monday morning, that I invited him and Mayor Scruggs and the potential buyer in this deal to the Goldwater Institute for an open meeting with the public to make sure that there was transparency. Too much of this deal has gone on in back rooms. And the other thing that was happening is that, you know, as you noted in the prelude to my coming on, people are pointing to the Goldwater Institute and sort of scapegoating us that this is somehow our fault and saying that we didn't take meetings. You know, we have taken dozens literally of meetings and phone calls with the city attorneys. We've been working on this for 2 years to try to get this information to the public. And when that was not honestly reported, we said, you know what? Let's just have our meetings in public from now on so that, you know, we don't have anything to hide and we want to make sure that nobody else does either. And funny enough, the NHL said, I'm not willing to do that in public. And that, as far as we know, by no response is the mayor's response as well.
Darcy, I want to just throw, the other thing I should throw out there is what the mayor has said, Mayor Scruggs, which is essentially is kind of a good money after bad argument. But anyway, that the city is in so deep with this arena that they have invested so much and put so much into the into professional sports that if this deal collapses, the economic situation for the city will be far worse than it would be otherwise. You know, the $500 million damage number that was thrown out there in a threatened lawsuit against various people, including the Goldwater Institute. What do you say to that argument that if this doesn't go through, it'll be worse and therefore it'll be worse for the taxpayers?
Well, I think those are just typical fear tactics that politicians put out there to try to push their agendas. You know, it's not this deal or no deal. Certainly, they could look around and see if a private buyer were willing to buy the team with his own money, the way that American businessmen usually do. And short of that, there are other options that you can use in an arena. But I think, you know, the problem here, like you said, is throwing good money after bad. They got themselves into this hole, and that's the classic thing that we say: when you're in a hole, stop digging. And they just want to keep digging deeper and put more more liability on the taxpayer's shoulders. And fortunately, in Arizona, we have a constitution that protects taxpayers against these kinds of government mismanagement.
I got to ask you a question because this is from afar. It's puzzled me. In the United States, where you have all kinds of sunshine laws, where you know transparency in government, especially, is very important. How has it been that a city like Glendale could, as you said, a lot of this seems to have taken place behind closed doors, and the city government there seems to work in interesting ways, that the bureaucrats seem to be making a lot of decisions, a lot of things seem to happen in camera, and very little of this seems to have aired out in actual council meetings. How has it worked that way?
It's interesting, and it's such a, you're correct that we do have a lot of these great sunshine laws. Unfortunately, cities don't have to abide by them if no one holds them to account. So if the councilmen are not recalled, if they're not hearing from taxpayers, or if an organization like the Goldwater Institute doesn't go to court to get them to comply with the law, they don't comply with the law. And that is the situation here, where we've already taken them to court to get these public documents, which have only been disclosed to us in the last 4 or 5 days. And that's like how it works everywhere, right? People abuse the law unless the law comes in and stops them. And so, unfortunately, we've had to do that in this situation.
One of the positions that your group has taken in this is that there has not been full disclosure of the documents requested by the Goldwater Institute from the city of Glendale. I understand that they've provided some, maybe all of the documents now, but it took them an awful long time. Has there been anything in any of those documents that has cleared up this mess, made your position any different, anything substantive at all?
There are some important papers in there, and the crux of this issue, well, part of it is over some ownership of parking rights and other things. And there are some documents in there that the city has said show that what they're doing is perfectly legal. And when our attorneys look at that, they reach the exact opposite conclusion. So if anything, what we're seeing now makes it look worse for the city, and does not give me any hope that they have constituted a deal here that is legal.
In conclusion, just to clarify the answer to the first question we asked you tonight, and that was, you know, if an attempt is made to process these bonds, the Goldwater Institute is clear it will begin some form of legal action. Is that correct?
Well, it's not dependent on when or what happens with the bonds. It's dependent on what we find in the paperwork and whether or not we determine with 100% certainty that this deal is illegal. So once we get to the bottom of the, you know, we don't want any surprises, basically. So
right.
Once we get to the bottom of this stack, then we'll know, and then we will make our decisions at that time.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, Darcy, but what I think you just said was that what you've seen so far, there's nothing that has changed your mind, certainly, and if anything, you have seen things that have firmed up your position. Is that right?
That is correct.
Thank you so much for taking time for us tonight. We greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for your coverage of this issue.
Darcy Olson is the president and CEO of the Goldwater Institute. So there you go. There's
it's pretty unequivocal, I would say.
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's interesting that perhaps we should have reached out to Ms. Olson previously because I think she's very clear in her position. And interestingly, over the last 4 or 5 weeks, there's been all kinds of gray area about what the Goldwater Institute is, what their motives are, what they plan to do, whether they're threatening or not threatening, why did they send out information to potential purchasers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she answered all the questions. And I suspect if we'd talked to her 2 or 3 weeks ago, she probably would have had the same opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right.
We'll take the break. When we come back, a severe concussion, a fractured vertebrae, was it a dirty hit? We'll talk to Mike Boone of the Montreal Gazette when Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network, Sirius 97, and Rogers Sportsnet. Past the hour. McCowan and Brunt, our Toronto studios. It's Primetime on the Fan Radio Network and on Rogers Sportsnet. Oh, along with Sirius 97. Sorry. Did it out of order. That'll never happen. Well, it might. Oh, the whole hockey world is all a Twitter over the incident between the Montreal Canadiens and the Boston Bruins, the injury to Max Pacioretty, a concussion, fractured vertebrae, a serious concussion, a fractured vertebrae as a result of the hit by Zdeno Chara, and then today the league deciding that no disciplinary action would be enforced against him. And if hockey fans in general aren't in a tizzy over it, imagine what they're doing in Montreal. To fill us in, here's our friend Michael Boone of the Montreal Gazette. Boone.
Hey, Bob.
Are we hiding sharp instruments in Montreal? Is there a danger of another Rocket Richard riot? What's the status?
Yeah, we're getting the pitchforks ready.
Okay.
We always have them close to hand, you know, between politics and sports.
I understand.
Yeah.
Now, Mike, I read what you wrote about last night on Habs Inside Out on the blog, and then I read the message board after what you wrote. Well, stake out your position first, because I think, you know, there's a lot of us who in the moment watched that thing, and again, watching it over and over again today and trying to decide what it was we saw other than a horrific injury, maybe the most horrific injury I've ever seen on a hockey rink. But what do you think you saw last night?
You know, as I wrote on the blog, Stephen, I'm kind of sitting on the stanchion on this one. It's really tough to read Chara's intent. But what we tend to factor in down here is the whole backstory with Chara and Pacioretty, who have had a thing going through two games and most of a third last night. But the actual play, you know, it happened so quickly. Had it happened anywhere else on the ice surface, would the result have been the same? I don't know.
But geez, Mike, there are people who are absolutely convinced that, you know, all of the backstory, as you say, between Chara and Pacioretty specifically, between the two teams in general, coming off the nasty, nasty game before, that Chara took his arm and directed Pacioretty's head into the turnbuckle.
There's a still photograph that showed up on Twitter that makes it look that way, but lacking depth of field, it's kind of hard to say. It's not the you know, as I said on the blog, it's not the WWE, and as Murphy noted in that decision, with which I do not agree, but maybe we'll get to that later. Chara does not have the history of playing that way. I think if he were a dirty player, you would have had fatalities now during his 10-year career. I mean, he's the biggest and strongest guy in the league. Did he try to run Pacioretty's head into the turnbuckle? I don't think so. Did he try to take him out with the puck nowhere in frame? Absolutely. Was he maybe trying to knock him into the bench? I don't know. And I think their history definitely played into it. They've been trying to get Pacioretty, as I said, through two games now, and it had kind of a tragic end to it. You would have been You know, you've been to the Bell Center, Stephen.
Yes.
The atmosphere in the place is like, it was a tomb. It was eerie. And after the period, you know, they deferred the 16 seconds to the beginning of the third period, and the players went off. And again, you could have heard a pin drop.
Mm-hmm.
So out roar the two stupid golf carts to fire T-shirts into the crowd.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. It was very, very weird.
With Michael Boone of the Montreal Gazette. I don't know whether you would share this view, but my view, and I think Brent's to some extent here too, is that while it is impossible to determine intent in this case, and I mean impossible, you may presume it, but you cannot determine it, that should even be raised as a question or a factor in meting out punishment. Which it is all the time in the National Hockey League. I mean, they will use whatever scenario, whatever language they need to substantiate whatever decision they come up with, good, bad, or indifferent, harsh or lenient, and in this case, lenient. But the truth, I mean, at some point, doesn't this league have to recognize that even if you don't intend to do something, if your actions cause someone the kind of severe injury that Pacioretty has suffered, there have to be ramifications. That's how society works. Michael, respond, please.
The National Hockey League is not society, or you know, if it is, it's one that's rather primitive, and you'd have to go back maybe millennia to find an analog to it. It's you know, you all the arcane rules that they have. You complete the check. You have to be aware of where you are at all times on the ice. Because you can get your head taken off at any time. That's just the way the game is played. And how do you change that? I don't know. The best player in the league, arguably the best player in the world, hasn't touched a puck since January 5th. Who can we talk to about that?
You can't even talk to him, you know.
No, you can't even talk to him.
I'm interested in from both you guys. Are we going to get to the point? The issue here is the injury occurred almost assuredly because of where the incident took place. And that was the end of an open space along the boards where there is no glass and the beginning of a section where there is glass. There are at least four such spots on every hockey rink in the National Hockey League and almost everywhere. And we understand that, you know, even if you put padding up, if you angled the glass at that point, I mean, we don't know that would have made any difference in this. But do you guys think we're going to get to the point at somewhere where the National Hockey League is going to have some libel chill and have to do something about this?
You mean liability in terms of what?
Well, and I refer back to the Columbus Blue Jackets game where the young 12-year-old girl was tragically died as a result of being hit by a puck, and within 24 hours... nets were going up behind the glass, and they still exist today.
I think
never come down.
I think the thing is that as a player, you do assume risk, and it's not like walking down the street, which is why there is a different system. If people say, well, if you did that to somebody in a bar, you would go to jail. It's true, but you're not in a bar. You are assuming risk as a hockey player.
Is that a reasonable risk? Michael, is that reasonable risk?
Yeah. You have to know where you are. You're aware of where the stanchions are. What was troublesome about the... Well, I don't know if troublesome is the right word. What was odd about the situation was it was a 4-0 game, 16 seconds to go. It was such an anodyne play. You know, the puck had just been chipped up the boards. They were going to play out the period, and boom, a guy is lying on the ice, seemingly dead, by the way. The other thing about the location of it was the RDS, I think, was... Yeah, they probably did the TSN feed as well, but the RDS camera was right there. And on the giant screen in the Bell Center, you were watching Pacioretty's face. He didn't move an eyelash, man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, half the building thought he was dead.
Yeah.
It was just, it took your breath away. Never seen anything like that.
Well, you know, you mentioned the Murphy, Mike Murphy's... rationale for the decision. And, you know, there's a couple of things there. First, we should talk about that, which is that it was a hockey play, you know, that it happened and that it was interference, but there was nothing extraordinary about it except for the kind of bad luck of the location of where it happened. The other thing, I guess, Mike, and you know, I talked to our pal Mitch Melnick about this early in the evening, but the fact that Mike Murphy is making this decision because the guy who's in charge of discipline for the NHL has to recuse himself anytime the Boston Bruins are involved. And I don't understand how you can operate that way. But let's start with what Mike Murphy said about why this is not a suspendable offense. What do you think?
He has a better, he played in the NHL. He has a better idea of a hockey play than I. But the point that I found kind of ironic in his decision was him pointing out that Chara never left his feet in the course of making the play. Well, no. Who was he checking? Shaquille O'Neal? The guy is, Chara's 6'9".
Yeah.
He doesn't have to leave his feet to hurt anybody. Again, hockey, what level of mayhem is a hockey play?
Well, and I mean, I would submit to you, Mike, I think you're being too lenient, to be honest with you. I would submit to you that anytime the National Hockey League drags out the phrase "it's a hockey play," they can do it for any. They can make the argument that anything that happens on the ice,
well, not
is a hockey play.
Well, not Todd Bertuzzi mugging Steve Moore. You couldn't. That was never. No one ever argued that was a hockey play. That's the difference.
Which happened, by the way, 7 years to the day before last night.
Yes,
that's right.
But
I don't know that. I mean, did the National Hockey League do a mea culpa? Did the Vancouver Canucks do a mea culpa?
Oh, that's a whole other thing.
Did Todd Bertuzzi even do a mea
culpa? But
no one
said that was something that happened in the normal course of play, that a guy jumping on someone's back and pounding him in the head was part of the normal course of play. So it doesn't apply to everything,
right,
but it can apply to a lot of things.
All right, fair enough. Cite me one other. Can you?
Well, I think the Brashear-McSorley thing was never, no one ever argued that was a normal, that was a hockey play either. This is.
I don't know about that. I mean,
you hit a guy over the head with a stick. I don't think anybody argues it's a hockey play.
I mean, I'd like to go back and look at the transcripts of what the National Hockey League said and how they responded to it in terms of meting out punishment or anything else.
I just think
all I'm saying to you, yeah. Stephen, is that I think these guys will trot out that phrase to substantiate whatever decision they decide to make
thing. I would say they do it often, and anything that looks like hockey that doesn't look like a fight or an assault with a deadly weapon,
well,
they will call it a hockey
play. A fight is part of hockey, isn't it?
Well, I haven't heard that argument made over a fight.
They weren't going to call anything at all,
Yeah.
Neither ref raised his arm last night until they saw what had happened to Pacioretty.
Because that kind of...
One of them said to Mark Recchi, we were totally calling the aftermath. They wouldn't even have called interference.
Well, Mike, that kind of interference isn't called, right? All the time. It is a little bit more since they've tightened up, but if you're rubbing a guy out on the boards long after the puck is gone, they don't call that all...
That's very true.
Yeah, and I'm not sitting here in any way suggesting that what Chara did was deliberate or had any malicious intent. And I'm not convinced that if he'd done it 5 feet further along the boards and all that happened was Pacioretty got squeezed up against the boards and the glass, I submit to you he probably would not have been hurt, or if he was, it would not have been anywhere nearly as severely, and no official would have called anything, and no one would have paid any attention to it. But that shouldn't mitigate the punishment that's meted out. Again, what the player's motivation was, what his intent was, should be irrelevant.
The on-ice punishment was based on what had happened, because whoever heard of a game misconduct for interference?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
like a three-game suspension for too many men on the ice.
Well,
that makes sense.
Mike, if I was at Hurley's tonight or somewhere on the main...
And he and, would be, if
yes,
you could.
Yes, and I would be. What would I be hearing?
We tend to feel a little bit put upon down here, Stephen, as you may know, from in our fair city. And we there's a lot of feeling here that the Canadians don't catch a break from the NHL. They're a smaller team, team that relies on speed and skill. And I don't know. We kind of think they should be protected a little bit more by the league, especially against teams like Boston and Philadelphia.
Mr. Boone, watch yourself. Hostilities can break out at any time in Montreal. We don't need to get caught in any of the mayhem.
I try to avoid stanchions.
Michael Boone of the Montreal Gazette. Glenn Healy will join us. We'll get his take on this. I can't wait for that. When Primetime continues on the Fan Radio Network, Sirius 97 and Rogers Sportsnet. Now 16 before the hour. Now in front of you. Here's Glenn Healy of Hockey Night in Canada. Well, guess what we're going to talk about? We just spent the last 15 minutes or so talking to Michael Boone. Montreal's all upset about the Chara hit and the and I think more about the lack of discipline as a result of the hit. To begin this, do you think Chara should have been subjected to supplemental discipline?
Brunt, first off, has changed in a big way. Did you know that, Bobcat?
No, I did not. Why?
He showed up at Pat Burns' thing.
Yeah.
He looked like Tom Cruise the way he was dressed.
Really?
Oh, like a male model, scarf around his neck.
Please, not possible.
Oh, I'm telling you. Ever since he's been on your show.
And you got those legs, man. I got to tell you.
Oh.
I've seen his knees before. I've seen him in the outfit.
Right, I piped in the first show we did, remember?
That's right.
Don't forget that.
I will never forget that.
No.
It was one of the most embarrassing moments of my career.
Anyways, no suspension. Fine with it. There's no precedent for that. The stanchions are there. It's an unfortunate hockey hit that turned out wrong. Big, big guy who plays whistle to whistle. He's not a dirty guy. He's not a guy who gets suspended all the time. He's had one fight all year. It, to me, is unfortunate, the ending. But you just can't make it up as you're going, and Mike, I think, has done a good job here.
Boy, there you can understand people in Montreal, Glenn. You know, there's emotions are running high. There's these two teams' emotions run high anyway. They saw a guy that's the most gruesome thing I think I've ever seen on the ice, just about, and I thought he was dead, and like a lot of people did. And you know, if you break down the, you know, it's kind of the Zapruder film effect here. If you break it down far enough, you get a shot where it looks like Chara is directing his head into that turnbuckle, that stanchion, with his arm or his hand. It's going to be, you're not going to convince people in Montreal that that's not what happened, I think, right?
No, you never will, and there's a couple reasons why. I mean, the injured list gets longer and longer. Pacioretty was finally starting to become a regular pro and a real good one at that. He was a real spark for their club. And, you know, the list is long. You know, guys like Georges and guys like Markov, and okay, here we go again. And this is a club who's closing in on the division lead. And, you know, it happens, okay, after they have a fight night that where Boston really takes advantage of Montreal. In fact, the night that they had all the fights, Montreal had two players down and could have kept filling them in, didn't. Boston did the opposite. When they had players down, they continued to fill them in. And so, as a result, you know the league is going to, you know, have their super spidey sense up for the next game and let these clubs know that you can't have this shenanigans. And now we have a player taken off in a stretcher. It's a scary moment, for sure. And those stanchions are dangerous, dangerous things. And I've seen lots of players go into them. I'm between the benches every Saturday night. I see players go into the stanchions right beside me. I see players bail out when they get close to those stanchions because they know they hurt. And so, you know, in that particular case, I'm sure Pacioretty would probably look at it and say, maybe should have bailed here instead of taking that extra stride because he was in a vulnerable position. It was interference. It was a major penalty. But it's not Chara's fault that the Montreal Canadiens have put those stanchions up. It's also not Chara's fault that the board and glass in Montreal is considered by the players to be the hardest in the National Hockey League. And it's time for Montreal to change that.
Let me put it another way then. Just throw it at you one more way. How can it in the moment be 2-5 in a match and therefore an illegal act worthy of throwing a guy out of a game in the middle of a hockey game and causes a severe, severe, severe injury, and after the fact is not worthy of... How can one thing be true and the other thing be true?
Well, again, what's the precedent here? I mean, you have to, if you have an incident, then you have to have something where you can look back on it and say, well, the last player who got pushed into that stanchion, we gave him two games. Or, you know, there doesn't exist that. And, you know, it is too
well,
bad.
Okay, but wait a second. It exists now, so therefore, by that criteria, the next time this happens...
Take them down. Take the stanchions down. There's no need for there to be one little pane of glass between the two benches. Get rid of it. The onus is on the club to make.
Yeah, but okay, all right, but that's not I agree with that. I'm perfectly willing to accept that as a logical reason. Although you do have glass that begins on either end of the players' benches, and you'd need to address that situation if possible. I'm simply getting back to the precedent thing. If the precedent has now been set, and the precedent is if you run some guy into the turnbuckle, there's no supplemental discipline. I mean, is that how you're going to run it? Is that the answer? Because I mean, this precedent thing is something the NHL trots out all the time. Well, if you're wrong the first time, you're going to be wrong every other time after that, Healy.
Well, you can make that point, and Mike Murphy could have made that point today, and there would have been some discipline. One or two games, whatever you want to call it. He chose not to make that point today because he obviously felt that the penalty on the ice was significant, and he also felt that maybe the player who was closing in on that stanchion should have been maybe a little bit more aware that you got a guy who's 6'11" who's going to run you out pretty close to that. So put the brakes on, bail, and do what most people do on a Saturday night in front of me. We could look for a different result, and we could start a new precedent, and maybe the Spidey sense is up with them, and they're thinking of going down that road, but they didn't think of that today. And when I look at Chara, I mean, was it late? Well, the puck was gone, but he's finishing his hit. He's a big guy, and it's a hockey hit to me that just turned out really bad.
Yeah, I know. We can go around in circles on this forever, but I guess the thing, and I hope that Chara wasn't trying to put him into that.
He's not that type of guy, though, Stephen. He's not. He's a caring guy who it took the Ottawa Senators an entire season to get him to eat one chicken wing.
I know.
Yeah, but there was also an incident in the prior game.
There'd be like flares coming off from my boat. Okay.
I understand. And you may very well be right. I'm not going to sit here and, I mean, it'd be stupid for me to argue with you about that. I don't know Chara. I have never seen him. I acknowledge he doesn't seem like the type. Having said that, there was an incident, and there was videotape of an incident in the prior game between the two teams where there was an incident in front of the net involving a cross-check to the back, and Chara got plenty mad, and he was trying to get at Pacioretty, and I don't think anything ever happened with it. I think people got between them, if I remember correctly. But there was a little bit of history, and given that, you could have looked at that and said, geez, are you 100% sure that he didn't know who that guy was coming up on the inside and didn't respond accordingly? Well, I'm not 100% sure of that.
And there's lots of bad blood between these two teams.
You bet there is.
It goes back to playoffs last year when Lucic, a couple of years ago, was skating around the ice and everyone's following him around, calling him a hunchback. And, you know, him and Komisarek had their incident and he got suspended and Komisarek got off of his suspension. And it's just a rivalry that gets heated and beyond belief. And Boston may be a tougher team and physically took advantage of the Montreal Canadiens two times ago when they played. And, yeah, there's definitely more on the line when these two teams play than probably a Boston playing against Phoenix. Sure.
I don't know. See, I just, you know, Glenn, I've gone around in circles on this, but I think he had to give him something. I think Murphy had to give him something.
I would have felt more comfortable if he gave him something. I'm not comfortable with the notion of trying to determine intent. I think, you know, clearly there was no penalty was going to be called until there was an accident. And if you use the same kind of logic, you can't determine what the player's intent was, in this case, Chara, whether it was deliberate or accidental. But if you're going to give him a penalty, and it's as a result of there being an injury, then I think you have to give him some supplementary discipline because there was an injury and it was severe. And at the very least, Chara was careless, at the very least. And I'll leave it at that. That's whether right or wrong, and many people will think that's wrong.
Well, it's difficult to read intent. It is difficult.
It's impossible.
To look into the eyes of a player and
impossible.
Say, you actively planned to pick me up.
That's right.
And throw my head against that stanchion. That's a difficult. You are going down a slippery slope when you start trying to read players' minds.
Agreed, and that's why you can't. You can never use, and the NHL will trot this out regularly. We don't believe it was his intent to commit this act. Therefore, there was no punishment. Well, you can't read intent. You can't be sure of intent. You have to eliminate that from the equation and respond to the act itself.
And follow the body of work of Chara.
5 cents.
For 13 years, if he had intent for 13 years, you would have saw a parade of people leaving the ice just like that.
I don't dispute that necessarily, but people do change. Look at you. We got to go. See you tomorrow.